Hello, hello, and welcome to That Garden Show. My name is Shannon.
And I'm Harmony.
And we're so glad you're with us for another episode.
And a quick PSA, November 3rd is right around the corner, so don't forget to take a moment to vote and use your voice. During the course of this story, you'll see how spooky things can get when elections are involved.
And speaking of spooky, this story is a little on the PG-13 side, so if you have some little ears nearby, maybe tuck them away for this episode. Now let's get into the story of Andrew Kehoe and the Bath School Massacre. Now, Andrew Kehoe was born in Tecumseh, Michigan in 1872, and there's really not a lot said about his early life other than his mom died when he was 18, and he went to Michigan State University for a degree in electrical engineering. And after getting that degree, he moved to St. Louis area and was an electrician for a while. And possibly while working as an electrician, he fell and incurred a head injury, which left him in and out of consciousness for quite a few weeks. It was even said it might have been a coma. After he got out of that coma and was kind of getting back on his feet, he decided to move back home with his dad and his new stepmom, Frances. And it was kind of mentioned that he might not care for Frances much, but no one really knew why. And so one day, Frances was lighting the family's oil stove, and something was malfunctioning about it, and she caught on fire, like her clothing. And in the moment, Andrew was able to grab a bucket of water and throw it on her. But because it was an oil fire, it actually perpetuated the problem and it didn't put the fire out at all. Harmony, she died later that day from her injuries.
So I just want to, real quick, we have a college-educated man in the 1920s with an engineering and electrical degree who tried to put out a grease fire with water.
This is a true story. And this is
not... Not calling his intelligence into question. This is just saying that there's a really good chance that that was not an accident.
Right? Yeah, there was no investigation into this fire, but many later on in life kind of questioned if that was a malfunction on purpose or, yeah, if he was somehow to blame for that situation.
Although I can see in a situation like that where, you know, you don't know what to do, maybe you do the wrong thing, and that's totally possible, but it sounds unlikely given his background.
Right, and the water did sound pretty available, like the bucket was already full of water and ready to go, but yeah, that's a little questionable for me. So getting back into the story, a year later in 1912, he marries Nellie Price. Now, Nellie was the daughter of a wealthy family in Lansing. So a year later in 1912, Andrew marries a woman named Nellie Price. And Nellie is the daughter of a wealthy family in Lansing. And about 7 years into their marriage, Andrew and Nellie end up buying a house from Nellie's aunt. And it's about a 185-acre farm in Bath, Michigan, which is about 10 minutes outside of Lansing. And it was said to cost $12,000 at the time. And I looked it up. That's about 180 grand today. So they were living on this farm and life seemed to be going fine. His neighbors did describe him as being intelligent, but a person you didn't really want to get into a fight with. You know what I mean? He just didn't like to be wrong.
I don't think anyone has ever described me as intelligent, but someone you don't want to get into a fight with. It sounds a little scary, just a tiny bit scary.
It is slightly terrifying, isn't it? Thinking of it. It was even a report I read where a neighbor said that his dog ran on Andrew's property and the dog would not stop barking. And so Andrew shot and killed the dog right there on his property. And another instance that I don't know if they knew of this at the time, but apparently he was upset with one of his horses and he sadly beat the horse to death. So there was some animal cruelty there that might have been some early signs of what we're about to get to. But at the time, it didn't seem that those were too big of red flags.
Yeah, now those are huge red flags. I mean, there are people that would be more upset about him killing the dog than a person.
I mean, the horse was a hard one for me, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, just to beat a horse because he was upset with it.
Yes. So this man, Andrew, he has this large farm and he apparently is always seen trying to do his farm work with the tractor. He doesn't do any of the hand work that, you know, other farmers were still kind of graduating out of at the time. He was always trying to try new ways of pulling different, you know, plows or pieces that he could kind of invent a new way of farming. And one neighbor even mentioned that one year that did not work at all. And instead of harvesting the hay, he just let it stand for the rest of the season and never harvested his crop, which I found pretty peculiar.
So maybe his heart wasn't really in farming. Maybe he was more interested in the engineering and innovation side of it and didn't really feel like he was meant to be a farmer.
Yeah, I think the electrical part of his life was, it sounds like, is where his passion was. I'm not really sure what made them choose to get the farm, other than maybe that was just the thing to do back then. But so he had this animal cruelty background that didn't quite raise a red flag at the time. And then he was elected in 1924 as the school board treasurer. And so he was known as being a very frugal person, someone who was tight with the money. He was always pushing for lower taxes in the school district, mainly because he himself did not want to pay higher taxes. And he was even said to have questioned the superintendent's financial mismanagement. He scrutinized often the superintendent's purchases and why he spent money on very necessary school equipment. So that was a little peculiar. And then in, I believe, 1925, the very next year, he did a brief stint as the clerk, the township clerk. Let me just do that little part over again. In 1925, he did a brief stint as the township clerk in Bath. And when the election came in 1926 in April, he actually lost that township clerk position to the superintendent, who he was giving a hard time to at the school. And so when he lost that election, that is really where people kind of say the story really begins. But I kind of think it started further back. But so his wife at this time, Nellie, she has tuberculosis, Harmony. So she's, at the time, that's a terminally ill disease. And she's in and out of the hospital a lot. He had stopped paying on his farm. And he made frequent trips to Lansing, which was only about 10 or 15, or only is about 10 or 15 minutes away. But he would make frequent trips to pick up dynamite from various stores, but was constantly going back and buying more dynamite.
So he's having a tough time and he's going through a lot of different things. And I'm not anybody to say how anybody should grieve, but it doesn't sound right to me that dynamite is the best answer when you have some problems in your life.
Yeah,
right?
This was a very thought out plan. I mean, if you look at it sounds like months that he was spending going and making these dynamite trips. And then he had access to the school because they had hired him to do some electrical work. And then in the summertime, nobody was there. And it sounded like the school was kind of accessible in general in the summer. And so he was able to go into the basement and wire this dynamite throughout the entire bottom basement level of the school over a period of time.
Wow.
Yeah. So on May 16 of 1927, that was when his wife, Nellie, checked out of the hospital for her last stint with tuberculosis. And he took her home. And it's no one's really sure when he killed her, but he did kill her sometime between the 16th and the 18th of May. And on the morning of the 18th is kind of where this all goes down. He woke up early in the morning. He moved Nellie into one of his farm buildings that had already been wired with explosives. He killed the rest of his farm animals. He set off these explosives, and almost simultaneously, they say, he set off the explosives that he had put under the Bath Consolidated School. And so when people started showing up his house to respond to the fire, he told them, "You should really get down to the school." And people didn't really understand what that meant until they got there and, you know, they saw all the explosives that had gone off. And so even Andrew Kehoe himself goes down to the school and sees, you know, what his, he probably thought marvelous work was, had taken place. And it actually turned out that half the school did not detonate. So he did blow up the north wing, but the south wing never exploded. So there were some survivors that he was not anticipating. And when he pulled up on that school property, he found the superintendent, his arch rival of this whole story, and was in an argument with him when he detonated the last of the bombs, which were in his vehicle. And those killed himself, the superintendent, and a few children that happened to be nearby, leaving his overall count at 45 deaths and 58 people injured. And to this day, Harmony, that is the largest school massacre that has taken place. And it's also one of the oldest.
Wow, that is a wild ride. And not to trivialize any of this, you know, for sure, we definitely want to be respectful to all the victims involved and everything. But it's interesting to be able to look back on things like this in the past, but also imagine, you know, how that would play out if it were today.
Yeah. So that was like a quarter of the children in the town. I mean, this was a very big deal in the town, and it did hit the national media coverage for about a day. But there was another national, or maybe it was even an international news thing that happened the very next day. And so they really didn't get a lot of coverage, which the town kind of said they were happy about because they had more time to grieve personally rather than, you know, being the center of a media circus like that. So, yeah, it's a very crazy story. There were a couple of people who survived the incident who were interviewed a few years back during the 75th anniversary. And those people who were survivors were around 93 at the time.
Oh, gotcha.
You know, Harmony, with this being the biggest school massacre of the United States, it's not really talked about as much as you would think. But there is the Riverwalk Community Theater in Lansing, Michigan, who actually did an awesome original piece about this on Zoom earlier this month. You can still find it on their YouTube and on their Facebook page. And just in the topic of theater and performing arts, there are millions of people across the country that are out of work during this pandemic in the theater and performing arts industries. So I hope everyone remembers how important the arts are to our communities, especially when, you know, our states continue to open back up, hopefully next year. Thanks again for tuning in to this special Halloween episode of That Garden Show. We just wanted to share with you this crazy story and true story of when a farmer in an election could go wrong, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Okay, guys, now all we have left to do is party time. First question, Shannon, comes from Caitlin, and Caitlin wants to know, do we grow mushrooms, and if so, do we use a kit?
I'm so glad you asked this, Caitlin. I ironically just took an introduction to mushroom cultivation class yesterday. I do not yet grow mushrooms, but I look forward to doing it soon. I hope to grow oyster mushrooms as a start and do it inside. I was not going to go with a kit based on the information I learned yesterday, where I could pasteurize some straw and mix it in, inoculate it with some spawn, and then do it in a plastic bag. So that was going to be the route I was going to go. But the kits look really cool, and I have considered buying them before. How about you, Harmony?
I have not started growing mushrooms either. It's something that's on my list as well. I have quite a few friends who do, and it looks really cool, like the whole process of it. And obviously, like, I eat mushrooms all the time, so it makes sense. It's just not something that I've had to do. But if you grow mushrooms and you guys have an interesting way that you do that, share that with us. We would love to hear from you guys. I know I've seen people do it, to grow mushrooms out of Uncle Ben rice bags. That's actually a really common thing. There's an entire subreddit on Reddit about growing mushrooms out of Uncle Ben's rice bags. As weird as that sounds, I'm curious if you do that. Let us know how it goes.
Nice. You know, they brought up coffee bags yesterday as a method too. I wonder if there's a strand on Reddit about that.
There might be, yeah.
Our next question comes from Treasure in Southeast Michigan, and she wants to know what herbs are commonly used in witches spells.
Okay, so this is actually a really good question here, Treasure. Anything that you can grow can be used in a witch's spell. And if you think back in history about the people that were called witches, traditionally it was women that lived alone, women that were independent, and women that had a lot of folk medicine that they used. And sometimes when we say is it magic or is it science, it's a little bit of both. So for instance, sage was used in a lot, and it still is used in a lot of purification and cleansing spells. It can be used to ward off evil, but it's also anti-inflammatory and it helps with fever. So if someone was sick and they had a fever, but they thought it was because they had a demon, then they were treated with sage, which has that anti-inflammatory properties that can help with that fever. There might be some confusion whether that was actually, you know, magic or if it was medicine. Dill is used. That's another one that's used for money and new job spells. Mugwort. I love the word mugwort. It just sounds witchy. But that's used in dream magic, astral projection. And then we have ginger. Ginger is an anti-nausea medication. It was used and still is used for morning and motion sickness. I used it when I was pregnant with my oldest daughter. It really does help with nausea. But it's also used to attract adventure and joy. So there's a lot of different herbs that can be used, and it really just depends on intentions and what people are looking for. So Shannon, do you know of any specifically?
You know, I looked up the spell in Macbeth just for fun, and it called for an eye of a newt. And so I was like wondering what could the eye of a newt possibly be. And I looked that up, and it was a mustard seed. So I think even sometimes in those older spells, they would use these whimsical and fun ways of describing herbs and different pieces of the garden. But, you know, they're all common things in the end of the day.
Okay. Next question is from Ashley. When do you pull a pumpkin or a gourd? What do you look for?
Great question, Ashley. You want the stem to start dying back. You don't want it to look green and lush anymore. But, you know, you can leave it out there a little bit longer if it's not frosting. Here in our area, it needed to be cut by now. But one thing, if you're using your squash or your pumpkins for decor, one thing that can really help lengthen the shelf life of them is rubbing some Vaseline on the outside. Now, of course, you don't want to do these to the ones you're eating. This is for the decor specific. But that Vaseline will help with the moisture and the shine of the outside of the skin, and it'll help lengthen the decor life.
Yeah. And if you want to test, there's another way you can use. It's the fingernail test. So basically all you're doing is you're just trying to scratch the pumpkin. And if it dents, but it doesn't puncture it, then that's how you know it's ready.
Our last question comes from Kate from Black Barn Farm, and she wants to know, what's the scariest thing that has ever jumped out at you at the garden?
So I have been really fortunate that I haven't had too many scary things. I haven't had too many animals to begin with. So I would say probably the most startling thing would be a mouse one time that jumped out, and mice aren't that scary, but I was not expecting it. So, you know, it gave me a little jump.
Sure. You know, the first time I saw what a vole actually looks like was a little terrifying for me. But it was already dead when I found it. I don't really have anything scary either. I'm one of those weird people who don't mind spiders that much. The thing that's maybe the most pestery when it comes to the garden is a woodchuck that used to live in my neighbor's yard behind me. And this woodchuck, I swear, knew how much it bothered me because it would just stand on the property line and eat its little food staring at me, and it would drive me nuts. You guys, we're always looking for more questions for Party Time. And if you want to share with us your scary story about something in the garden or maybe your favorite herb from a witch's spell, we'd love to hear about it on Instagram or in the Facebook group.
And be sure to check us out on all major podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, at That Garden Show. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and if you really like what you hear, leave us a 5-star review and tell your friends.